yesterday, the day before, some information in general. No, okay. So far we haven't done anything that's really too hard, though I'm afraid at this point it's going to start to get harder. Today and tomorrow will maybe not be particularly detailed, but what I want to do is I want to give you kind of an overview of how one actually builds a quantum computer, and the different techniques people have thought of, worked on, and in many cases actually even implemented. But it's not an experimental course, obviously, and we're not even going to go into much detail about these. So today I'm going to focus on one in particular, and then tomorrow I'll probably give you an overview of a few others. So to get started, let's think about what we actually need out of an implementation of quantum computation. So we want to be able to build some device that can do the quantum circuits that we talked about yesterday and the day before. And so what conditions are we going to need on the device for that to be a sensible thing and for us to be able to call it really a quantum computer? And so David DiVincenzo came up with a list of criteria that has become the kind of de facto standard for that people look at when they're building an implementation. Now, as it happens, these criteria are not really either sufficient to build a big quantum computer, because you also need some more conditions that make sure you can do fault-tolerant quantum computation, nor are they actually even really necessary, because some of them can be loosened a bit. But they still serve as a kind of a good baseline for telling you, you know, what you should be looking at and looking for when you try to build a quantum computer or design an implementation. So the first one says that you should have qubits. In particular, it says you could have a scalable physical system with well-characterized qubits. So what that means, there's kind of, well, so there's, I guess there's a lot of keywords in there. Some of them are kind of obvious, like it could be a physical system as opposed to just something you're making up. Qubits, I said that's kind of the main point of it, that you could have qubits. Of course, you know, it doesn't really necessarily have to be qubits in a two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. If you really want, you could build a quantum computer that has qubits made up of three-dimensional Hilbert spaces or something else. But that's kind of a minor point. The main points beyond the obvious requirement of qubits are this word scalable and this word well-characterized. So well-characterized means that when you build this device, you have something you call a qubit, but you should be able to know the properties of that qubit so that you can control it well. Okay? And that can be an issue because, you know, sometimes there are manufacturing processes which will maybe produce lots and lots of qubits, but each one of them is a bit different, and maybe it's hard to tell exactly what the energy levels of this one are versus the energy levels of that one. And then it's very difficult to really do anything with these. So that's the well-characterized part. And the scalable means that you can make lots of them. Because, you know, after all, if we want to make a big quantum computer, it could be possible, at least in principle, to make lots of qubits as part of that computer. Okay, so then criterion two is kind of a preparation condition. So you have the ability to initialize Thank you. So you should be able to initialize the qubits to some standard state, like state of all zeros for the qubits. And that's also kind of important, although as it turns out, there's ways around it. The idea is, well, you want to do a computation. You want to start off with your ancillas, with your qubits in some known state. Because if you know they're just something random, then you do this computation. And well, if you do a computation on a random input, you're going to get a random output. It's not necessarily going to answer the question that you wanted to answer. Okay, condition three then is about decoherence. So condition three says that the decoherence time, the time that it takes to basically go from some quantum superposition to some classical bit, or just in general to have some errors occur, that should be much longer than the time it takes to do a single quantum gate. And that makes sense, right? Because if these timescales are comparable, then that means that every gate you do is going to have a lot of errors in it, or a very high probability of error. And it's going to be very hard to do anything under those conditions. Whereas if something like this is true and your control is also very good, then you'll be able to do gates that are pretty close or usually will be correct. And after that, well, you still have to do error correction and stuff on top of that to make it work. But at least this is enough to get you started. So by the way, I'm supposed to ask about volume for the microphone. Am I too quiet? That seems unlikely. Or am I too loud? I can turn down the volume. Yeah, but it's, no, it's OK? OK. OK, so that's number three. Then we have condition four, criterion four. So condition four says that we have a universal set of quantum gates. Of course, this is what we were talking about yesterday. So we need some set of quantum gates that you can put together to get any unitary. And of course, you need some way to implement those gates on your physical system. And then number five talks about measurement. Says we have a qubit-specific measurement capability. So what that means is that, well, at the end of the computation, you've done your unitary operation, and you want to look at the answer to your computation. So you want to look at some qubit that has that answer and see what it is. And what he means by qubit-specific is that it's not enough to just say, well, we have all these qubits, and let's take the average of the expectation value over the qubits. And you know, some systems, it's hard to specifically target measurement on individual qubits. You do only kind of get some averaging thing. Well, again, there's ways around that. But it's certainly much more useful if you can look at specific qubits and measure their outcomes. And typically, you might want to measure more than one qubit, right? You might want to measure 5, 10, 20 qubits. And it's nice to be able to do that for all of them. So another thing that's not really necessary for a quantum computer, but it's also kind of helpful, is if you can do measurements on part of the qubits in the computer, but leave some other qubits still coherent. And sometimes you can do that, sometimes you can't, for various reasons. OK, so these are the kind of the main DiVincenzo criteria. So if you have these, you can build something that's worthy of being called a quantum computer in some sense. It may not be something that you can scale up indefinitely, but it's certainly something that you can start to do interesting quantum circuits on. Now, another thing that you might want to do is quantum communication, things like protocols like quantum teleportation or quantum key distribution, which we'll talk about probably in the third week. So things that involve people in separate locations trying to share some quantum resource between them or jointly do some quantum activity. And to do that, you need maybe a little bit more, because these just say that you can do computation in one site. So you need some way of connecting distant sites. So to do that, you add two more criteria. Number six is the ability to interconvert between stationary and flying qubits. So stationary qubits are qubits which kind of sit in your quantum computer and you can use them to do gates. Flying qubits are qubits which kind of move from place to place. So like the obvious example of a flying qubit is a proton, tends not to stay still very well. Protons are very useful for communication. They're a bit harder to do computation on, though you still can. Whereas maybe you want to use atoms. So for instance, you might imagine using atoms for your stationary qubits and then use photons for your flying qubits to communicate between distant atoms. And then seven is a condition on the flying qubits. You should have the ability So you should have the ability to faithfully transmit flying qubits between specified locations. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. The flying qubits have to go from Alice to Bob, and you should be able to do that reliably. Okay? Yeah?
Is doing measurements usually harder than the rest of it?
So the interesting thing is it depends a lot on the physical system. So there's some systems where 1 through 4 are pretty easy, and 5 doing measurement, that's hard. There's some where measurement is pretty easy, but I don't know, number four, for instance, can be very hard. Basically any of these can be the hard thing in some system or the other. I mean, usually we don't really even consider very seriously systems that don't have long decoherence times. But there's lots of systems that you can certainly do all this other stuff very easily, but the decoherence times are too short. And then they're good for classical computation, but not much good for quantum computation. I would say there's number one is maybe the one that's kind of the easiest, most uniformly, that there's lots of systems where you can do that. But even that, I think there's some systems probably where you could do many of the other things, but one would maybe be questionable. I don't have a good example of that offhand, but it varies a lot. And so that's kind of one of the interesting things about what we'll be talking about today and tomorrow, is that you'll see there's a lot of implementations. They tend to have different advantages and different disadvantages. And it's a difficult task to find some implementation that's perfect in all respects, that's kind of best at everything. And so that's maybe one reason why building a quantum computer is hard, because there's a lot of different things you have to trade off against each other. Okay. There are other questions on the criteria here? Okay. So in that case, let's look at an example in more detail. Maybe I'll just do this report. Okay, so let's talk about the ion trap. So ion trap is built around a system where the qubits are going to be stored in atoms, in particular in electronic energy levels. And so in particular, the atoms we're going to use are group 2 atoms. Like calcium, for instance. And so group 2 atoms, they have 2 electrons in their outer shell, if you remember your chemistry. And we ionize them once. So that means that there's only 1 electron in the outer shell. And then the energy state of that electron is the qubit. Okay? So we're going to have maybe some ground state and an excited state. And we can say our ground state is 0 and our excited state is 1. Okay? And so there's some energy difference between this ground and excited state. Call that E. And what we're going to do is we're going to, in order, oh, yeah, okay. So there's a couple of things. So first of all, so one effect of having this ionized atom is that we have 1 electron in the outer shell. Another effect is that the atom is charged. The ion is charged. And what that means is that it'll interact strongly with electromagnetic fields. And in particular, we can trap it with magnetic fields. So you can't do this with static magnetic fields, but with time-varying magnetic fields, you can make some sort of trapping potential effectively. And so that's, of course, where the name of this implementation comes from, right? Because they're ions and they're trapped. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to control these atoms with lasers that we shine on them. And that's going to let us manipulate the state of the electron. So in particular, we have, so let's just, for the moment, let's think about just having 1 ion in this magnetic trap. So we have a Hamiltonian which is a sum of 2 terms. So one is kind of the intrinsic Hamiltonian of the atom. And one term is going to be caused by the interaction of the laser with the atom. So we're not going to treat the laser quantum mechanically in this case. We'll just think of it as classical light. But it still has a... It's classical light because it's in a coherent state. I don't really want to go into that. But it'll still have kind of an effect on the quantum state of the atom. And so in particular, well, the Hamiltonian of the atom, that just encapsulates this energy difference. So we can write this Hamiltonian as EE with a scale E for the energy difference between the ground and excited. So this is saying the ground state has energy 0, and the excited state has energy E. And of course, you know, there will be more than 2 energy levels in this atom. So actually, there's other terms here that correspond to other excited states of this atom. And eventually, we're going to be using one of those other, maybe 2 of those other excited states. But for the moment, let's ignore that. okay? Because I just want to concentrate on these two energy levels. And then, so the effect of the laser on this is the laser, well, we're going to give it a frequency. Omega, which is equal to E over H bar. So the laser has an energy per photon that's equal to the energy difference here. So that means that the atom can absorb a photon and go from the ground to the excited state. Or if it's an excited state, it can emit a photon, stimulated emission, into the laser. And it'll go from the excited to the ground state. And so that the effect we'll get from that is a Hamiltonian term that looks like this. So this term says that if you started as excited, you could go to ground. And this term says if you started as ground, you could go to excited. And then these phase terms basically compensate for the energy difference between the ground and excited. Okay? Everyone okay with this so far? Okay, so what happens when we turn on the laser for some amount of time? So suppose we start in the excited state. And so let's measure over time. So suppose we do the following experiment. We start out with the atom in the excited state. Let's start out with the atom in the ground state. And then we turn on the laser for some amount of time, and then we measure the atom. I haven't told you how to do that yet, but we'll measure the atom to see whether it's in the ground state or the excited state. Okay. So over time, what will we see for the probability of being in the ground state? Well, at time zero, we have to start at one, because we're starting in the ground state. And then as time passes, well, ideally what we should see is, certainly qualitatively speaking, what will happen is the electron will sometimes transition to the excited state. So this will go down. Then there's the possibility of getting transitions back from the excited to the ground state. Okay. And if you solve the Schrodinger's equation here in this idealized case, what you find is you find that the initial ground state will go to cosine jt over h bar times ground plus sine jt over h bar times excited state. So you should see a sinusoidal oscillation. But what you actually see is something a little bit different. So let's stick in half here. So what you'll actually see is, well, it'll start out, it'll look pretty good, and it'll come back up, and then it'll go down again and come back up. But what happens is these oscillations get smaller and smaller over time. Okay? And actually, in the ion trap, it takes a long time. You actually can get many, many oscillations before it really noticeably gets smaller. Because the reason that the oscillations get smaller is because of decoherence. Okay, because sometimes when you have a superposition, say somewhere in the middle at some intermediate time, something like G plus E, there'll be some spontaneous dephasing, effectively some measurement by the environment that will tell you whether you're in G or E. Okay. And that will collapse it either to, you know, back to 1 or to 0. And then you'll start a new oscillation, but it'll be out of phase with the original one. And the overall effect of that is that this oscillation gets damped by some exponential envelope. And so they just take time with the oscillations. It is basically the decoherence time in this system. So so this is a way, this experiment, which is called the Rabi oscillation experiment, is both a way to demonstrate that you have pretty good coherence and actually to measure the decoherence time at some level by seeing how many oscillations you can do before the thing decays. Okay? Any questions on this? Yeah.
So how small has the amplitude to get to not be able to distinguish between the two states?
Well, so you can always still distinguish between the two states. So what happens, what it does,
but in practice,
it decays to 1/2. So it means you get ground and excited with almost equal probability. And how well you can distinguish that basically is the question of how many times you do the experiment. Right, because it's a matter of statistics. Right, if you're only doing it a couple of times, if you run it up to this time, and you only do it once or twice, then it'll be hard to pin down exactly where you are. There'll be a big error bar. But if you do it, a million times, then you can have pretty good statistics and say, oh yes, it's about 3/5 right now. So it's kind of up to you. I mean, There's always the possibility of other things that will vary over the times, each of the trials in the experiment, and that may limit the, it may be that statistical error is no longer your limiting factor, for instance, that there's some systematic error. And again, that depends on the system and how well you can do the measurements, how well you can do the other operations that you're doing. Other questions?
When you're treating G ideally, shouldn't we have energy in the cosine side?
No. See, because what I've done is I've set the energy of the photons in the laser to be exactly equal to the energy difference in the atom. And so what that means is that that the total energy between the electron and the laser, that stays constant. It's not actually an exact number because the laser has some varying energy levels, but depending on how many photons it has. But actually the energy cancels out here. Okay, other questions?
How does it happen that interacting with those photons is not a measurement itself?
So this is I was kind of sweeping that under the rug. So this happens because the laser is kind of this coherent state, it's classical light. And so what that means is that adding a photon to the laser or taking a photon away from the laser doesn't significantly change the state of the laser. I don't really want to go into that. That's a whole other topic. But that is in fact what happened. Okay, other questions? Okay, so for ion traps, like I said, you can do many, many oscillations before you get a big decay. And so what that means is the ion traps have kind of long intrinsic decoherence times relative to the time to do a gate. Because this is an example, really, of a 1-qubit gate, right? So, so Rabi oscillation gives us 1-qubit gate, some 1-qubit gate. By simply turn on the laser for some particular time. And depending on the time that you choose, you can do a bunch of rotations by different angles, right? So if you do it so that JT over H bar is pi over 2, then you'll change ground to excited and excited to minus ground. Okay, and then if you do it for a time pi, well, you'll get back to the original state, but possibly with a phase shift. I guess in this case it would be an overall phase shift, so it's maybe not that interesting, but it turns out we'll need that in another situation. And on the other hand, you can also do it for a time pi over 4. And then the original ground state will go to ground plus excited. So that's a little like the Hadamard transform. I don't think the phases are exactly the same as the Hadamard transform, but it's similar. Okay? So that gives you a really an infinite set of quantum gates. Anything that does kind of rotations between this ground and excited state in this particular basis. Okay, so that's one set of quantum gates. And moreover, we know that for the ion trap, the time to do this is much less than the decoherence time. And that's why you can do lots of oscillations. And so that's kind of telling us that condition 3 is satisfied, at least for the 1-qubit case. Okay. So, but this is not actually all 1-qubit gates, because this is just 1-qubit gates that will kind of mix between ground and excited. But we also want, for instance, those phase rotation gates. So I said if you do a pi pulse, you get a phase, but it's really just a global phase, right? Because cosine pi and sine pi, well, sine pi is 0, but cosine pi is minus 1. But that's a global phase. What we'd like to do is take some superposition of ground and excited and change the phase of excited state without changing the amount of each basis state that we have. Okay, so we also want diagonal gates, like phase gates. But those are easy to do too. And the way you can do that is you turn off the laser. And so now if you wait, for time t, well, what happens? Well, now we've set, so we're controlling the lasers, and the laser intensity tells us what j is. So j is controllable by us. And so if we set j to 0, turning off the laser, that means that the only Hamiltonian term we have is H atom. And so what does that mean? Well, that means that the ground state, nothing will happen to it, and the excited state will get a phase. Anyway, it's a phase, I think, e to the minus I et over h bar. Okay? So by picking an appropriate amount of time, we can do any relative phase rotation between ground and excited. Okay? And so putting this together with the gates we get from turning laser on, the Rabi oscillation gates basically, we have now rotations about two axes in the Bloch sphere. And putting those together in some order, we can get any rotation, anything in SU2. So from these, we can get any single qubit gate. Okay? So now we're well on our way to condition four. We have all single qubit gates. But if people have questions on the single qubit gates. No? It's okay. Okay, but of course, in order to do an interesting quantum computation, we need not just single qubit gates, we need a two qubit gate, like a controlled NOT gate. And the controlled NOT gate is going to be more complicated. So maybe I'll switch to this board.
A question.
But yeah.
What's a single qubit gate?
What do you mean? What is a
what's an example of a single qubit?
Oh, so the Hadamard transform is single qubit gate, the phase rotation is single qubit gate.
Only this kind of case.
Yeah, and you know, this, I mean, I didn't tell you what happens to the excited state, but if you figure out what happens to the excited state, this is a single qubit gate as well. So single qubit gate is just any unitary that you apply to one qubit.
But
yeah.
Here we only have one ion. If we have two ions, then do we have the single qubit gates?
Right, so, okay, so the next thing we're going to do is we're going to imagine putting multiple ions in a trap. And so remember, these are ions, they're charged, they all have the same charge, plus one. And so that means that they repel each other. So they like to spread out. And so usually you have a linear trap. These ion traps tend to be linear. And so what will happen is the ions will kind of space themselves more or less evenly throughout this trap. Okay? That means there's some distance between them. And because there's distance between them, what we can do is we can try to shine a laser on just one of them at a time. Okay. But it's true that when you do this, you know, if the laser is not narrow enough, it may get also little light on the neighboring qubits. And so that's a source of error, that sometimes you get kind of a crosstalk. But in the ideal case, you can do this pretty well. I mean, well, the ideal case, you do it perfectly. But in the real world, they can actually do it pretty well. OK? So the other thing about the fact that these ions are charged is that if one of them starts moving in this trap, it'll push the other ones too. And so what happens is you get vibrational modes, essentially. Of the ions moving in the trap. So there's, of course, if you have n ions in the trap, there's going to be n different modes. So one of them is where they all move together, the sloshing mode. And then you also have something like the breathing mode, where the left half will go opposite from the right half, and so they spread out like this, and they come back together. And then, of course, you'll also have higher modes as well. So today I'm going to focus on the lowest mode, the breathing mode. And because these are single atoms, and we're dealing it, we try to kind of keep it everything in the quantum regime, this means that the vibrational mode is also quantized. And then for low amplitudes, it looks more or less like a harmonic oscillator. So we have a new term in the Hamiltonian, H phonon, and that's H bar nu A dagger A. And so indeed, this is usually called a phonon, which you probably heard about phonons in condensed matter class. You know, you didn't do this condensed matter class. You heard about phonons in condensed matter, right? Okay. This is an example of a phonon mode. It's not maybe precisely what you think of when you think of a solid state system, because it's just kind of a one-dimensional crystal of only a few atoms. But it's still really a phonon mode. It's a vibrational mode, and it's quantized. And this phonon mode, it involves all the atoms in the trap. And so there's some trick we can use to use the phonon mode to cause the different atoms to interact with each other. Okay, so how are we going to do that? Well, so the idea is to think about now just a single atom within this trap and look at the joint energy levels of a single atom and the phonon mode. So what does that look like? Well, we'll have the zero phonon case, and we'll have the ground state and the excited state of the atom to those. And then we'll have one phonon, and again we have ground state and excited state for the electron. And then we have two phonons, and again ground state and excited state, and so on. Of course, the number of phonons could be arbitrary, but we're going to be focusing on the case where there's not very many phonons in this mode. Okay, so let's think about this energy level. So about these energy levels. So the distance between the ground and excited states in each of these pairs, that's E. And the difference here between say two different ground states that differ by one phonon, or two different excited states that differ by one phonon, that's H bar nu. Okay, so the difference here between the excited state with zero phonons and the ground state with one phonon, or here, this is going to be H bar omega. And here H bar omega is E minus H bar nu. Okay, so that's simple subtraction. But what it means is that if we use a laser, with this frequency omega, as opposed to the omega that I had on the other side, so if we use one that has energy E per photon, it will interact ground and excited state without changing the number of phonons. But if we do it that's kind of detuned by this amount H bar nu, now the laser is matching energy levels here. So what happens is this laser will couple the states that have E for the atom and N phonons with G for the atom and N plus 1 phonons. Okay. So basically, there's some kind of recoil from absorbing the photon or emitting the photon that causes the atom to start moving. And because it's charged, it will transmit that movement to all the atoms. And so they'll all move together. Okay? So this is a way that we can couple the atom qubit stored in ground and excited state with the phonon mode. And then the idea is we're going to use the phonon as kind of a bus to interact different atoms indirectly. Okay? And so in particular, the thing is, that this laser will couple E with n phonons to G with n plus 1 phonons. And so when we're up here, that's fine. That works equally both ways, right? So if we start with G with 2 phonons, we'll interact with E with 1 phonon. And if we start with E with 1 phonon, we'll interact with G with 2 phonons. But down here at 0 phonons, there's now an asymmetry between E and G. Because E with 0 phonons can interact with G with 1 phonon. But G with 0 phonons can't interact with E with minus 1 phonons because there is no such thing. Okay? So G 0 phonons does not couple to this laser. Okay? And that lets us do something that's fundamentally different between the G state and the E state. And that's kind of a conditional operation. That's what gives us a quantum gate. Yeah?
So for each kind of these things, we need a laser, right?
Yeah.
And
so we need, that's right. So we need one laser that has energy E per photon. And we need a different laser that has this different energy per
right.
photon. So it's going to be a different laser.
But then it sounds to me there is no guarantee. When you add an ion to this trap, we can still do anything because the modes would change and then the laser.
Yeah. So what happens? So what happens is they make the trap. They say we want a trap. Well, okay. So actually, I think it's not really the case. No. I guess that's right. So it's not really the case that a single laser necessarily has a fixed frequency. So sometimes there's some kinds of lasers where you can tune the frequency. But basically what you can do as an experimentalist is say, we want to make a trap, we want to put this many ions in the trap, and therefore the frequencies are this, we should get a laser that's this, has this frequency. I mean, there's lots of other trade-offs that they make. They say, well, we want to use this atom, and we want to use these particular energy levels in the atom, so that we have good lasers that will interact with the right energy. So there's a lot of things they can do.
Right.
But actually, the phonon energy levels are relatively small compared to electronic energy levels, which is kind of how I drew them. So I think that's kind of secondary. Yeah?
You can also probably control the modes by controlling the magnetic field, which currently
ions. That's pretty true, yeah. So they have that additional degree of freedom to kind of set the stiffness of the trap.
Mm-hmm. And then it might also mean that, for example, having 10 ions might be much easier than, for example, 3 ions.
No, actually, having 10 ions is harder. So the main problem is that they, I think there's a number of problems, but one big problem is that they tend to get crowded in this trap. So if you have a trap of a given size and you put more and more ions into it, then the atoms get closer together.
Yeah.
So you have less space to, and therefore more bleed over crosstalk between the atoms. And also there's the fact that you have to be able to manipulate each of these atoms separately. So you have to be able to move your laser to each of these different positions where the atom is. Anyway, they can do all sorts of things with these ions. I haven't heard them complain particularly about it's so much easier to do fewer ions than more ions. It's quite the contrary. Okay. So how do you use this property to actually do quantum gates? Well, the the trick, as I said, is to use the photon as a bus. So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of move the information. So we have two ions that we want to interact. And what we're going to do is we're going to take one of them, we're going to move the information from the ion itself into the photon mode. Then we can interact the photon mode with the other atom and then move it back. And so this is the Serac-Zoller gate. And so it consists of the following steps. So in order to do this Serac-Zoller gate, we're going to use one of these additional electronic energy levels that I mentioned before. So I'm going to call that E prime. And E prime has energy big E prime. Okay. And so kind of step zero is we want to initialize the phonon mode to have zero phonons. So that we can make use of this asymmetry that happens when we have zero phonons between the ground and excited. And then we actually want to do a gate. Well, first we turn on a laser with that frequency omega, which was, what was it? E over h bar minus nu. And we do a pi over 2 pulse. OK, well, what does a pi over 2 pulse do? Well, it's basically the same Rabi oscillation thing, except now it's between the E0 state and the G1 state. So we have E for atom 1 and 0 for the phonon. We'll get mapped to G for atom 1 and 1 for the phonon. Whereas if we had G for atom 1 and 0 for the phonon, well, then it doesn't couple to anything. So it stays as G0. OK? And then step 2. So now you'll notice that no matter what state the electron started in for atom 1, it's now in the ground state. But the information that started in this qubit is now stored in the phonon. The phonon is either 0 or 1, depending on whether the qubit was 0 or 1. Okay. So now is when we interact the phonon with atom 2. So this is on atom 1. So now we do a pi pulse on atom 2, but we do it with the frequency call it omega prime, which is E prime minus E over h bar minus nu. Okay, so we have a similar chart to the energy levels up there, but instead of using G and E, we have E and E prime. Okay, and so if you put a laser with this frequency on, you'll interact E prime with N phonons with E with N plus 1 phonons. Okay, it's just the same argument. And so the effect of that is, so if we have a state that looks like this, then this couples to, so E is now the lower energy state, like the ground state. It couples to E prime with zero phonons. But you're doing a pi pulse, So you switch it to this, and then you switch it back. And so you get an overall minus sign. So this goes to minus E2 with one photon. But there's a bunch of other possibilities. So the states, if we started with E2, but we had zero phonons, then that doesn't couple at all, right? Because this is, remember, this is replacing the G state in that argument above. So this stays the same. And if we started with G, with either zero or one phonons, well, this laser frequency, I mean, assuming the energy levels are chosen appropriately, this laser frequency doesn't do anything at all to the G states, because there's no other energy levels that are this distance apart. Okay, so this, these two states will stay the same as well. Okay? And then in step three, we do the pi over 2 pulse again. Let's say minus pi over 2 pulse, so 3 pi over 2 pulse on atom 1 with frequency omega. And so what that does is it undoes step 1. And so it maps G1, one phonon, back to E1, zero phonons, and G1, zero phonons, stays the same. Okay, so now we've moved the information back from the phonon to the first atom. And so we can really have a two-qubit gate between the two atoms. And so now let's look at what that gate did. Well, so suppose we had four possible initial states. Where the first atom could be ground or excited, second atom could be ground or excited. So in both of these cases, well, we started with the ground state for the first photon, so we never excited the phonon mode, so the phonon mode stayed zero. And that means that here, nothing happened in step two. Okay, and of course in step three, again, we just went back to where we started. So these things just stay the same. And in the case where the first atom was in the excited state, well, then step one gave us one phonon, okay? And then step two, we had the ground state and one phonon, so that's here. But the ground state didn't couple, so nothing happened to it. And then in step three, we put the state back in the first atom. So this, again, returns to itself, E1, G2. But this case is where we have something interesting happening. So in this case, well, we put we got one phonon in step one, and then we were here. And so the pi pulse actually did something in step two. It gave us a minus sign. And then in step three, we put the information back in atom one, so we end up with just that overall minus sign. Okay, so this is a non-trivial two-qubit gate, 1, 1, 1, -1. And it turns out this is closely related to controlled NOT gate. Using just two Hadamard transforms, you can make this back into the controlled NOT gate. And therefore, this gate plus all one-qubit gates gives us a universal set of gates. Oh, well. Okay, so that's condition four. So let's see. So I guess how are we doing on the Stephen-Kenzer criteria? Well, we have three, we have four. Actually, we have one. I didn't really mention it, but we have the ability to put multiple ions in this trap. So let's talk about two and five, which basically are going to go together in this case. So how do we do measurement? And we're out of time, so I'll do it quickly. So measurement we use yet another electronic state. It's going to be a short-lived state that likes to spontaneously decay back to the ground state. So we have this picture. We have ground, we have excited, and we have the F state over here. And if we can put a laser that couples ground to F, and then F will spontaneously decay back to ground. So if we have a strong laser, coupling G to F, we get what's called a cycling transition. Where if it starts in G, it goes up to F, and then it emits a photon and ends up back in G, and then it goes, well, the laser's still there, so it goes back up to F, and it decays quickly back to G, and then it goes back to up to F again, and it decays quickly again. And so what's going to happen is we get many, many photons emitted from the F state. And they're emitted spontaneously. So this is kind of a decoherent process. It collapses. So if we had a superposition of G and E, well, the E state doesn't couple to F. So what's going to happen is G and E get decohered. And if the state started as G, well, there's a lot of photons we get emitted. And we can see that by seeing those photons. With photodetectors. Okay. And so that's how they measure whether you start in the ground or excited state, whether the qubit is in the ground or excited state. You put on this, you do this cycling transition, and if you get lots of these spontaneously emitted photons coming out, you know it's the ground state. And if you don't see anything, if it stays dark, then it's the excited state. Okay? And so that gives us criterion five. And then we can also get criterion two by saying, well, let's just start out in some kind of arbitrary state for the atom. And then we can measure whether it's the ground or excited state. If it's the ground state, we're set. If it's the excited state, well, then we can do a Rabi oscillation to a pi over 2 pulse to flip it back down to the ground state. OK, so that also gives us condition two. OK. So maybe I can take, if there's questions on this, I can take one or two questions, but then we're over time, so we can pick up tomorrow. Yeah?
As for the measurement, do we also not want to be able to measure the relative phase in the grounds inside this state, not only the probabilities of being there?
There's a limit to what you can measure, right? So you have to choose, either I want to measure ground versus excited, that would be one possible measurement. Or if you prefer, you could measure a different thing, which is whether I'm in ground plus excited or ground minus excited. So that's a separate projective measurement. And you can do that by doing a pi over 4 pulse that takes the ground plus excited, say, up to excited, and ground minus excited would then go down to ground. Okay, and then you do this measurement. So this is a case where you kind of the physical operation you have is only measurement in one basis. But then you can use your universal set of quantum gates to change that into any other measurement that you like.
So if we want to have the full information about the state, we would have to perform the quantum algorithm many times. And
that's right.
At the end,
so they do what's called a state tomography, where you create many copies of the same state And then you do different measurements on each copy. And that will give you full information about the density matrix. But from just one copy, of course, you can't get full information. So. Okay? Yeah?
Why do we need lots of photons?
Oh, well, it's a very simple reason, which is that if there's only one, you might not see it.
Right.
Maybe your photodetector will not detect it, or it'll go off in the wrong direction, or something like that.
But the measurement could occur.
Yeah, so you'll still collapse G versus E, so you won't have the superpositions anymore. But you won't have the measurement itself, because you won't know what the outcome is. Okay? So that's it. Tomorrow, I guess I'll talk about a variety of other implementations. Not 100% sure yet. We'll see.